Accession number 16714, Richard Forbes, reel 6.
Mr. Forbes, Reel 6. Did you have any discipline problems with the troops in France?
Well, not as such, but the usual sort of things did apply. This is why the customer of officers carrying walking sticks came in, because as we were dressed exactly the same as the troops in every possible degree, the only warning they may have of trouble appearing with somebody with a walking stick. So if they were doing something wrong, or intended to do something wrong, if they saw that walking stick, "Hey Fred, you better stop that lot, look who's coming. It's Mr. Forbes with a walking stick." The stick was not used physically, but it was used as a symbol of authority. Take it as you like, but it certainly worked to a certain extent. Now if on the other hand, you've got somebody who is used to boozing an awful lot of beer, French wine was so cheap, the troops just used to buy it like beer and drink it like beer. But of course what they didn't realise was the alcoholic content was far in excess of Brunel or whatever it is they drank at home, you see. So invariably some of them got not only drunk but violently drunk, and caused an awful lot of trouble and damage, not only to themselves and others in the battalion, but also sometimes to civilians. So of course something drastic had to be done. So apart from the normal ticking off and withdrawing of privileges, our colonel, we're still all right, our colonel, who of course served in the First World War, on one or two of those who refused to accept normal restraints, gave them field punishment. In the First World War, field punishment involved tying the individual to the wheel of a gun limber where the payout was made, so that every time any man came up for his pay, he would see this chap tied up there and saying to himself, "Well, if I misbehave, that's going to happen to me." Now, we couldn't do that in the Second World War, but we could give them pack drill. Now, this was pretty hard going. So the man was fully kitted out with his rifle, with his pack, and the pack was either filled with sand or with logs of wood. And there was always a sergeant or a corporal in charge, and he had to walk, march, or double march round a specific area for several hours, depending upon how he is standing up to the punishment, or how the sergeant felt. And then at the end of the day, he'd be medically examined by the medical officer, and if the medical officer felt he was physically capable of standing more, he would have some more the next day. And that had a really salutary effect on these chaps who didn't know how to control themselves and drank too much alcohol. You may say, bring it back in 1996, but that's how discipline was imposed in the final end.
Minor wrongdoing. How was that?
Confined to barracks, doing minor chores, spud bashing, clean out the latrines, all those sort of things. But the main thing, of course, was confined to barracks. You know, if they want to have a night out, go to the local cafe and have a few drinks and take a girl out, that sort of thing. That was really hard on them because they had to stay behind. Perhaps had to clean rifles and do this, that, and the other. So it was the best sort of punishment, and it worked quite well. But the really bad offenders, they knew that if they overstepped the line, the big stick would come out, and that was it.
Did the men frequent the local estaminets?
Oh yes, the estaminets, of course, were quite different to pubs in England. And this was why, of course, the temptation was to drink too much wine, because it was so cheap. But on the whole, they behaved themselves, and the local populace weren't too hostile to us. But to a great extent, the attitude was nearly indifference, you know, why you're here and why we're involved in this war. But, of course, you see, their losses in the First World War were absolutely diabolical. I mean, nearly a whole generation disappeared, far worse than we did.
You did some, you mentioned earlier, you did some of your shooting and so forth over on the coast.
Oh yes, at Latuque it was.
What kind of activity was going on there?
Well, these were proper firing ranges in the sand dunes, and every man had to fire every weapon. So of course we started off with the rifle, then the Bren. This is a sort of toughening up exercise. We had like bags of ammunition now, of course, when it was nearly time to start fighting the Germans. So of course we had a marvelous time. So we had rifle, and then we had Dan Bren gun, anti-tank rifle firing, which have gone, we're jolly pleased to get rid of that, and hand grenades. Now this is interesting, hand grenades, little enclosure, sandbags, wall in front of you, then a little wall about 3 feet high just behind where you stood. So the thing was, the sergeant instructor was there with the officer, then the chap with the hand grenade in his hand, and the drill was, withdrew the pin, let the lever go, count three seconds, and then throw it over the wall, lie down flat, oop she goes, and that's it. But of course, what used to happen sometimes, A, the chap would suddenly take out the pin, let the lever go, and suddenly realise, I've got the power of death in my hand, and you'd freeze. So what the sergeant had to do within 2 or 3 seconds was to grab the grenade, throw it over the front wall, and fling the fear-ridden recruit over the low wall and lie down till the thing went off. Then, of course, another one too, of course, was training, to train the man not to throw it until it's nearly the end of its time to go off, and that was always the hardest part. But you also had somebody alert there to make sure that anybody who either A, dropped the grenade or froze with fear, the sergeant had to leap in and throw him over this low wall. Otherwise, of course, he would have been killed and everybody else.
What was the time fuse on the grenade?
I was trying to think that it was quite sure. I think it was between 2 and 3 seconds, which of course is 1, 2, 3. So there's a fair amount of time to take the pin out, let the lever go, take your aim and throw, you see. On the same time, if you want to make it land just on the point of explosion, you've got to say perhaps 1, 2, and then dive down, you see. So it depends upon the circumstances. But there were cases of people freezing.
Were there any accidents?
No. Fortunately, because the sergeants were well trained and very much alert and didn't mess about. If anybody happened to that one, he would just be the grenade taken out, flung over the top, and literally flung over this low wall. And then, of course, there's nobody hurt then.
Were there any parachute scares?
Yes, of course. The great scare was there were parachuting nuns down, if we're talking about when the fighting was on. This was the great scare, that the Germans parachuted nuns down and they could wander around passing back information. In fact, my first casualty was my favourite sergeant, Sergeant Harris. We were going with the carriers through this French village, and he was shot through the back of the head by a fifth columnist from an upper room in a village, in a house. Of course, we couldn't stop to do anything, but I was most grieved about that little man. And again, coming back to the indifference or even hostility, who are these British? And you shot through the back of the head. I've never forgotten that. Sergeant Harris.
Time coming up to May the 10th, were there signs of more activity which showed that something was about to
happen? Well, at our level, in other words, infantry level, we knew that something was cooking, but there was very little on the ring or even slipping down to us, but obviously intelligence knew it was going to come up any day, you see, and we work off on the, sort of dawn of May the 10th, and that was it. We knew it was on then, so we had to get on our motorbike straight away, zoom, up into Belgium. I got as far as Brussels, and then the troops came in, and I was still there. Funny incident there too. I was in a street in the centre of Brussels, and the anti-tank gunners, artillery, were lining up the anti-tank guns along this street. And a tearful woman came running up to me in French, of course I could speak French, you see, and said, I've left all my jewellery in my house and this man won't let me up because the gun's going to fire along the street. I said, right, never. I said, oi, Sarge, hold it. So I took her by the hand, she went into the house, grabbed her jewellery, came out, dashed away, said, right, oh, Sarge, carry on. And that's how the woman saved her jewellery. But you see, the Germans were so close, very shortly after, we had to get out as fast as we can, of course. From there, of course, it was a concession of hold back, retreat, hold back, retreat, and general confusion all the time.
So you did your task as the route planner, organizer.
That's right.
Did you come back to the battalion?
That's right. And then I rode, when I'd done all that, and the main body of the troops had moved up. I then rode back on my motorbike and rejoined the carrier, which was carrier platoon officer. And there again, you see, the sergeant would take over and run the platoon. It's no use bringing a strange officer and saying, right, there's the carrier platoon. So the senior sergeant took over. That's the value of the system, proving yourself, which was really good.
Was your motorbike an army motorbike or your own personal
one? Well, I used my own personal one in this country for whizzing around, but as soon as I got into France, it was either a BSA or a Triumph. And of course, I used to like riding about on that. And my job was always, whenever the battalion moved, I used to move several miles in front of the battalion to check everything out, and then drive back to the colonel and tell him what I'd found, you see. And there was only two officers who could drive motorbikes in the battalion, and Major Slight and myself were the only two.
And you rejoined the battalion. What was happening to the battalion now? It's May the 10th gone by, but you haven't yet moved yourself.
Well, they were still fighting rearguard actions, you see. So, of course, being a carrier platoon, my first job was rearguard actions.
Had you moved up into Belgium with the battalion?
No, I hadn't. I'd moved up into Belgium on motorbikes. Mm-hmm. Then when that job was done, I moved back and rejoined my battalion. Then the battalion, presumably, I think we moved a little bit further onto some of the canal positions. And then, of course, as we were driven back, of course, it was doing this all the time, backwards.
What are your memories of that withdrawal, that retreat?
Well, constant stopping a bit, holding them up a little bit, trying to snatch a bit of sleep, and incidentally being dived on all the time. This is the worst thing with Stukas. Whenever you move, there was a Stuka appear in the sky. So what we did in the carriers were designed for the Bren gun to fire horizontally. We fixed it up on the top, I don't know how we did it, fixed it up on top of the carriers, and we used them for anti-aircraft. So whenever a Stuka appeared, we were trying to bring them down. They were most frightening weapons because of the screaming they made when they were coming down from the sky. Because the theory was, you see, you slept low, saw your target, turned down, and you screamed down towards the target, and just before you hit the ground, you zoomed up again, then you dropped your bomb, you see. But the screaming noise they made was quite frightening. But I can still see Dixon now standing on top of the carrier with a Bren gun. He says, I nearly got him there, so.
Were the roads filled with refugees?
Yes, no, that was another terrible sight we had to bear. The roads full of refugees with their bundles, their cows, their horses, their children in great long columns, and Stukas coming down and machining right down the columns. And we had to force our way through these columns, which were coming down toward France, up into Belgium, and all this was going on because we just died in the ditches, you see. But it was a dreadful sight to see them doing all this to women and children.
Did this affect yourselves and the men?
No, we just had to accept it and put it behind ourselves that this is what total war means. And whilst we're so terribly sorry for them, we have a job to do, which is to fight to the best of our ability, and that's what we did. And of course, you see, being Durhams and miners in particular, the grit was already there, because I've often said, you see, that when a Durham miner went to war, he's only changing uniform, not changing his job, because his normal job was so dangerous and rough and hard, that being a soldier was just like going to work. It was the same when these experts and the Royal Engineers came round to show us how to dig trenches, and these pitmen would stand round whilst he was doing it, all mine numbers in, out, and then they would just say, hey, stand by to one side, get out here to dig a trench. And of course he'd do boom, 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 right there, you see, and he'd have a trench dug in no time. And the chaps would stand back, oh, see, that you know how to do it, do you? And of course that's because they were Durham miners.
Was this in the Lille area when they came up to show you how to dig trenches?
Yes, well, you see, a lot of trenching was still much in their thought, you see. And they were going to show us how to do it, but these miners soon showed them how to do it straight away.
Well, so you're digging a very large anti-tank ditch
there. That's right, yes, that's right. But they were coming around trying to show us how to do slit trenches, you see, which was the idea they were after.
You rejoined the battalion, as you say, when it was in Belgium.
That's right, yeah.
And then you were in this retreat, this withdrawal, back yes. through these crowded
Well, of course,
roads.
The carriers, you see, just like in England, they were ideal for this sort of operation. The battalion would say, right, you stick here, hold them off as long as you can, while we get the rest of the battalion back to the best position next down, you see. And then we would hold off as long as we could, then reform, then rejoin the battalion, then do the same thing. But, of course, we're all mixed up with French and Belgian soldiers as well, you see. So, of course, it was general chaos all round. So, of course, he often lost touch. Where's the battalion gone to? Here am I stuck out here, you see.
But, how did you keep in touch then? Tell you where they were heading to?
We had no radio, you see, in the carriers, unlike they do now, of course. And we just had to go by map reading. We're going to move back to so-and-so. You join us when you can, or until you think it's necessary. So that's how we had to work it.
What was the weather like?
Oh, hot and dry. It was excellent weather from that point of view. Clear skies. That's why the Germans made such havoc with the Stukas. They could just pick anything off they wanted.
Did you see civilians actually dead and wounded?
Oh, yes. Well, when we were moving up, you see, the civilians still had to move down towards France. Well, they could do nothing at all for the wounded. Neither could we, because we had to go and fight. So we just had to, if we had the chance, of giving them a bit of comfort or a bit of water. But we had to walk through all this lot. It was pretty horrific to do it. But
how we were able to get through these densely crowded roads?
Well, literally fought our way through. If it was if they were completely blocking the road, and we're in vehicle, we'd just smash our way through the hinges off, or fences, and drive over the fields, and then rejoin the road as best we could, because we had to get on, you see. And if there's a human barrier, we couldn't drive through it. We just had to drive around it.
We were able to get your usual meals.
Well, we always had hardtack with us, which was our army biscuits, the horrible things, hard and dry, and a bit of bully beef perhaps. But the cooks were absolutely wonderful, the way they kept us supplied with something of usually a hot meal of some sort, wherever we were. They did a wonderful job. But if they couldn't give us a hot meal, it was just army hardtack, which was bully beef and biscuits. And that's all we had, and water, of course. We began to realise how important water was, of course, particularly when you're wounded, because we used to grumble in TA camps. We always carry a full bottle of water with us. And if the officer or the sergeant stopped you and said, right, let's see your water bottle, and you hadn't got water or bottle, and you're on a fizzer, because without water, you're no good as a soldier. And we didn't see the point, of course, in training, but we did later on. Water.
What kind of distances were you travelling in a day?
Well, I suppose, what, 10, 15, even more, depending upon how it was going, because it was a question of halt, hold them off, get back as far as you can, because the idea was, of course, at that time, was to get as many bodies out of Dunkirk. Equipment would have to be written off, you see, but meantime, of course, you had to hold them up. So, of course, it was perhaps 10 or 15 or 12, whatever it happens to be, hold them, then move back and start again. So it was a question of, you know, doing this all the time.
You went into Belgium around about the River Esco.
That's right.
And then had to come almost straight back again.
Yes, that's right.
Where did you go to for your next holding position?
Oh, was it another canal? Was it Prover? Not Prover, Carver? Oh, I've got it. I can't remember. Yes, that's right. I remember La Passe Canal. And we're lined up there. And this is where the carriers came in, because we'd brought our Bren guns in with plenty of ammunition, and fighting was going on quite hard. So we sent our men out with the additional Bren guns to hold the canal as long as we possibly could. And then we had a small regimental aid post in our own platoon. And as the wounded were brought back to us, and we tried to form a bit of a sort of post to help them initially before they were sent further back. But it was obviously we couldn't hold the position very much longer, and eventually, of course, we had to leave. I always remember the first cattle I ever saw. We were going through, after this fighting, we were going through a village, and the houses were all burning, and all the telegraph wires were down, and this man was lying on his back, and a piece of shell had hit him right across the throat, and he was lying there with the blood all over the place and everything burning around about him. And this was our sort of first experience of what war really was. It was a horrible experience. But there again, we just had to drive through and very shortly.
Was he civilian or soldier?
No, he's a soldier. He wasn't a DLI man. He was somebody else. And he'd been fighting in the village, you see, and had moved back from the canal. Because
This must have occurred after you'd gone up onto the ridge at Harris
Well, after, yes.
The 6th and 8th Battalion attacks.
Yes, we were reserve battalion at Harris, you see. 6th and 8th went forward.
Do you have any memories of that particular incident?
No.
Of that particular action?
just that we were in reserve, we didn't take very much part in that particular action. But I always remember George Chambers of the 8th Battalion. He'd come back absolutely beaten to the world with all the fighting they'd done. And I think it was my servant, who'd flogged a bottle of wine from somewhere. And here was George coming around. So I said, "George, I can drink a wine." "Ooh," he said, "rather." So I gave him this bottle of wine. There he was, swinging this bottle of wine. But they look absolutely dreadful when they come out of action. They had a very, very hard time. And, of course, Rommel was very, very surprised, you know, at that counterattack. He didn't think the British had it in them. You see, everybody underestimated the British, including the French, and certainly the Germans did. When their backs are to the wall, that's the best time for them.
Do you remember the date that this happened?
What, Arras? Oh, I can't remember that date. It's in the history of the DLM. It's all mentioned. It's all written out. You've got those two books, by the way, have you?
So after Arras, immediately after the two battalions were withdrawn, what was your battalion doing then?
I'm not sure, but I think we were rear guard battalion for the brigade. I think that was the main objective. Although I did come across Ian English during the fighting, and then once just before I was wounded myself, I had Dixon out with me, sort of looking at the ground, and I came across one of the 8th Battalion carriers, which had one of its tracks smashed off and abandoned. But it had piles of ammunition on board. So I said to Dixon, I said, "Come on, there's no question of putting in an indent for this." I said, "Let's grab it." So we pinched all the ammunition from the 8th Battalion and put it on our carrier and went off. And we were in this position. And that was when, of course, I was wounded and taken out of action. But that was the basic idea, was to protect the rest of the brigade, you see, whilst they got away.
So the movement then of the division and brigade from Arras was backwards.
Backwards, yes.
Withdrawing. Do you recall any of the stages of the withdrawal until you were in action again, or when you were in action? There's places like Provins, these places.
Well, I can't remember the names of the villages because I hadn't got time to take note of them, you see. But all I was doing was fighting as long as I could in that position to hold them up, and then as it got untenable or I had to move to a better position, I would move backwards. But meantime, the battalion moved backwards as well, so it's a progressive thing. But I can't remember the names of the places we were in.
Any particular actions do you recall that you were in with your platoon?
Well, the main one, which was the last one, was when we were in my particular carrier. I got the carrier platoon spread out in a defensive position because they were not too far away. But Dixon and my driver were well in front of the rest of them. And we'd been holding this position and keeping them off as well as we could. But they were getting round the flank. So I said to Dixon, I said, "Look, it's about time we got to a better position to be more effective." So just as I said that, Dixon was getting the ammunition. So I was picking up the gun when I was hit, of course. And then I fell to the ground. And that was when Dixon sort of picked me up and dragged me under fire to the carrier and dragged me over the front of the carrier. And got me back to the regimental aid post. But that was, we were right in the forefront, as it were, completely isolated from the rest of the platoon and the rest of the battalion. So I thought, well, Weiss, this is all well and good. I'm not doing much good here if they're just going to walk around. Because that was another tactic that the Germans did. If they found it was only light resistance, they didn't waste a lot of time. Speed was the essence, so they'd just go around you like that, you see. So that was when I decided to move to what I thought was a better position.
Now, this was the action which, as you say, you were severely wounded, but you also got an award for it, didn't you?
Yes, well, that was just for that particular incident, but also all the succeeding ones, I got the Military Cross, the same as Ian English did, too. And I suppose that's one of the first ones to be awarded the Military Cross in the war, because it was one of the first ones. But that's how it went. I never thought about Military Crosses, just doing my duty. Because my duty was, the last words that he said to me was, "Forbes, you stay here till all your ammunition is gone," in that particular position. I'll never forget it. And of course, I stayed there until I was still able to do something. But of course, once I was wounded, I was completely useless.
And so, did the platoon extricate itself, or were you able to?
Well, the platoon extricated itself, but I was stuck out by myself, you see. So Dixon took it upon him and Corporal Howe, my driver, to get me on board, to get back to battalion headquarters to see how best they could serve the battalion in holding the Germans up, you see. But I couldn't do anything else after that because I was not capable of.
What happened when you were hit? Your feelings of, was it painful?
It's just like a rugby match, being hacked on the shin. I trying to get up to tell Dixon to get in a better position than I found I could. I just fell flat in my face.
Had you felt a great deal of pain at this point?
No. But and then of course it started to come on, but I couldn't move at all. So he had to drag me. You see.
Where was the wound?
Oh, it's in the tibia and one through the foot.
And what was it caused by?
Well, this friend of Eddie D said it was an anti-tank bullet. It might have just been an ordinary, but I don't know. But the thing was, I was crouching down, holding the Bren gun to lift it into the carrier. So, of course, my knee was cocked, so I think it just ran down my leg. That's what happened. And it's amazing how it stayed on all these years. But, of course, I've got to have attention for it now, but I'm still managing pretty well on the whole.
Your corporal and your batman brought you out.
Yes.
Where did they take you?
To the Found Battalion headquarters, and the medical officer, Bob Rutherford, saw me, did the necessary first aid, put all the labels and things onto me, gave me a jab, and then sent me off to in a truck to the 10th Casualty Clearing Station, this little village called Krombeke.
So the first aid, what exactly did he do?
Well, of course, he dressed my wounds to the best of his ability, and then gave me an injection, you see.
What did they inject you
with? It'd be morphine, I suppose, to sort of deaden the pain, because by then, of course, he knew that something had happened.
And what condition were you in then?
I didn't know what was going on at all. And, of course, with morphine as well, it was just a big blur. So to say, if it hadn't been for Dixon, I'd have just lain there, and they'd have had to move on and leave me alone. So Dixon got me out.
From the RAP, then you move back to number 10 Casualty Clearing Station.
That's right.
In this village.
It's in a big church in this village called Krombeke. And there was French, Belgian and British all mixed them together, all crammed in, cheek by jowl, foot by foot, on this church floor. It's just absolute chaos. And
what happened to you there?
Well, fortunately, a British medical orderly who was going around checking everybody because we were all in a different state of disrepair, he came across me, and a French doctor was the first one that came to look at me, and he wanted to amputate straight away, because I knew French, I wouldn't let him. And a New Zealand gynecologist who was working with the British Army, I got hold of him, and he said, I know nothing at all about surgery, but he said, what I'll do, I'll slap you in plaster, and set the leg to the best of my ability, and then we'll see what happens. And that's exactly what he did. Otherwise, if it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't have had my leg on today. Because the French had one policy: if you were even moderately wounded, either leg or arm, take it off. But this New Zealand doctor, and I forget, in fact, he's on that photograph, he slapped me in plaster and saved my leg. So that's what happened. But of course, there were literally hundreds of us all jammed in this place. And then I was mooted on the 28th of May, and the 29th, of course, the Germans were in, and that was it.
They came and took the
oh, yes, control. They took most of the medical supplies. But my point was, in that little note I made about the stick, was the doctors could have got away. They knew the Germans were coming in very quickly. They could have got away, but they elected to stay behind to look after the British wounded, which I thought was, you know, something, really, you know, because they could have made it. And there could have been perhaps a better use to the British Army if they got home again, but no, they're going to stay with the wounded.
Were there other medical people working there?
Well, of course, the medical orderlies, of course, with the British doctors, they were always there. And, of course, the French had their medical orderlies as well and medical doctors. Because it was such a complete shambles. They were all jumbled together. British, French and Belgium, you see. But fortunately, I can speak French, so I can make my way through it all. But they're absolutely marvellous the way they treated us, the British. And the other thing, the nurses from nunnery, if you like, they came in, and the desperate need for everyone that's wounded is water, water, water. The Germans, the supplies had all been broken, but the nurses defied the orders of the Germans and brought us water in, and we've never forgotten those nurses. They're absolutely marvellous to us, those nuns, rather. They defied the Germans and gave us drink. And there we were, all lying on the floor, some on the floor, some on stretchers. It was absolute chaos. But I say, we survived.